Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Hats for the Homeless donation drive. From now through December 15th, Fire on the Mountain on 57th and Northeast Fremont, Los Gorditos at 12th and Southeast Division, Mike's Drive-In in Selwood, the Cup and Saucer on Northeast Killingsworth, and the Old Salt Supper House on Northeast 42nd Avenue will collect clean, new, or gently used hats, scarves, and gloves, and the folks at Zippity News will distribute them to local shelters. Dropbox locations and more information can be found at KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Clinton Street Stomp, an evening of unamplified performances by some of the region's root music acts, playing the third Saturday of each month, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, the December 19th show features Crow Quill Night Owls, Caleb Plotter and Reeve Wilms, and Miller and Saucer, and hosted by country blues yodeler Zach Bryson. Again, that's the Clinton Street Stomp, Saturday, December 19th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBL Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial. My name is Patrick Buckhart. I'm your board op for Talking Earth. And we have out of the studio, we have our host, Barbara Lamornicella, back. Barbara, are you there?
Hi, I'm here, Patrick. And I want to thank you for this program because in November, you recorded the reading that we're playing tonight at Mother Foucault's bookshop in Portland.
Yes,
and it's a reading from a brand new anthology, Raising Lily Ledbetter, Women Poets Occupy the Workspace. And we're going to be playing an hour of that 90-minute reading tonight with four local contributors, Barbara Drake, Willa Schneeberg, Penelope Scambly-Schott, and myself, joined by Caroline Wright, the Raising Lily Ledbetter editor who journeyed from Seattle. Most people don't know the first act that President Obama signed when he took office was the Lily Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which Congress passed to remedy one of the many wrongs that the Supreme Court, did. Lily Ledbetter was an area manager for a Goodyear tire plant in Alabama. As in many large corporations, the plant workers' pay was a closely guarded secret, and she started wondering towards the end of her working life what her male cohorts were making, but she couldn't find out because it was a secret. But shortly before she took early retirement in 1998, somebody slipped a note into her mailbox giving her the figures. And she saw that from the day she began working for Goodyear until 1998, Lily had been paid significantly less than her male co-workers who did the same job. Her case went all the way to the Supreme Court, which in a 5-4 decision rendered by Justice Samuel Alito ruled that under civil law, Lily had lost her chance to sue because the deadline for a civil rights suit was 180 days after the first instance of discrimination. And Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote a very spirited dissenting opinion, which she read aloud, sensibly pointing out that as the pay scale was secret, Lily had no way of knowing that she was being discriminated against. And further, that the employers, quote, knowingly carried past pay discrimination forward in every 180-day cycle since Lily began working. Well, she lost her suit, but she is happy that her daughters and granddaughters will be fairly compensated now for their work because Congress in 2009 passed the Lily Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. We're going to open the reading tonight with Barbara Drake, who opened at Mother Foucault's. Only Barbara is on the line with us from her home in McMinnville, because we had a little technical trouble with the first part of the reading. Barbara is a poet, a writer, a teacher, an essayist, who retired in 2007 as a Linfield Professor of English Emerita. She lives on a small farm in McMinnville with her husband Bill, and tends sheep, raises bees, and is the mother and grandmother of a large clan. She knows a lot about women's work. She's published more than 7 books of poetry, several books of essays, and has won awards both for poetry and essays. I follow Barbara, and we'll go straight from her by phone to the beginning of the recorded part. I came to Oregon from San Francisco in 1968 and have lived rurally outside of Portland since then, and have co-hosted Talking Earth for many years, first with Walt Curtis and now with Patrick Bocard. I was honored to be awarded the Stuart Holbrook Prize for Outstanding Contribution to Oregon Literary Arts, to be selected by Carolyn Kaiser as a finalist for the Oregon Book Award, and to receive the very first Oregon Literary Arts Fellowship specifically for women writers. So I want to bring up Barbara Drake. Barbara, are you there?
I am here.
Well, great. And that was a wonderful reading that you did, and let's hear what you have to tell us.
Well, I just wanted to say thanks to Carolyn Wright and the other editors for putting together this collection. It's amazing. There are so many women that had things to say about work, their experiences with work, some of them good, some of them not so good, and it's a great collection that can tell you a lot about women's experience.
That's right.
And thanks, Barbara and Patrick. It's good to be with you tonight.
It's good to be here, too.
More than 80 poets in this anthology, so it's a big
collection. It's really a substantial piece of work, speaking of work. I always wanted to work myself, and I think people generally do want to work. And I like to be independent and earn my own money, and I save money for college and so on. But when I was growing up, it was really hard to get a job for a girl in a little town where I was. And so I sometimes envied the boys I knew who got fairly decent work wages when they worked on, blue-collar type jobs like summer flagging crews. And I think of that every time I go past somebody today out on the road and I see a woman with a hard hat on with the flags and stuff, and thinking back then women didn't do jobs like that. When I was young, the main job available to me was babysitting, which was like 35 cents an hour, 50 cents an hour, until I learned to type. And after that, my jobs were always involved typing. And my poem in Raising Lily Ledbetter is about that, and as well as about the tensions that sometimes arise between women in jobs where they are somehow not comfortable with one another.
Right.
And in different ways. It can be subtle. It can be overt. But I'm talking about a long time ago. So this is The Typist. I made 87 and a half cents an hour typing when I was a college student. I was a great typist. My woman boss used a spinneret, a recording machine with a mic and a foot pedal, to dictate puny little messages about things that needed doing. After I typed a message perfectly, she would read it over, change a word or two, and ask me to type it again. While I typed, she'd grab her cigarettes, go down to the coffee shop, and drink coffee with the director. I could tell she thought he was cute, but he was married. I had a kind of scorn for her, that she couldn't type her own messages, that she couldn't get it right the first time, that she did so little, and I was paid so little. So it's kind of a snippy poem, I know, but it's a true feeling that you can get when you're in a situation where you feel like you're underpaid and overworked and trying to deal with things. Yeah. So I did different kinds of work. When I was in college, I wanted to grow up to be a college teacher and a writer and have children and get married and do all kinds of exciting things. And I remember when I was a junior, my advisor said I should cut back on the literature classes and take some education classes because I might want a job teaching high school until I got married and quit working and had children. And at the time that happened, I just kind of stared at him and didn't know what to say. And so I just kind of went on and continued to study literature and creative writing. And I got married and had children and taught college and did it all. And so I ignored his advice, and I'm glad I did. And there are other things that came up. When my children were small, I worked at home writing high school textbooks and right in the middle of their playroom. And eventually got back into teaching college, although at one point when I asked for a job in the department where my husband worked, the chairman said if he hired one English department wife, he'd have to hire them all. So I learned that I was an English department wife, which I've not forgotten, as you can imagine. Maybe I'm a vengeful person, but things like that are hard to forget. But I did work my way back into tenure jobs, and I've retired all these years, and my main work is now my writing, but once in a while, I still teach a writing workshop because I really like it. And I like writing, creative writing, and other people's writing and reading. And so I'd like to read a couple of poems in the book by other writers in the anthology. Both of these poems are about working hard in different ways. So I think, how are we doing with time, Barbara?
Oh, go on. Fine.
Okay. This one is by Linda M. Hasselstrom, Clara in the Post Office. And it's a persona poem in the voice of Clara in the Post Office. Okay? I keep telling you, I'm not a feminist. I grew up an only child on a ranch, so I drove tractors, learned to ride. When the truck wouldn't start, I went to town for parts. The man behind the counter told me I couldn't rebuild a carburetor. I could. Every carburetor on the place. That's necessity, not feminism. I learned to do the books after my husband left me and the debts and the children. I shoveled snow and pitched hay when the hired man didn't come to work. I learned how to pull a calf when the vet was too busy, as I thought the cow did most of it herself. They've been birthing alone for 10,000 years. Does that make them feminists? It's not that I don't like men. I love them when I can. But I've stopped counting on them to change my flats or open my doors. That's not feminism. That's just good sense. It's an interesting start because I have heard people say I'm not a feminist. I just do this myself and so on. And I remember hearing Maya Angelou once at a conference saying, people ask if I'm a feminist. She said, I have to be, because I'm a woman. I'd be crazy to be prejudiced against myself. Anyway, so I really like that poem and all the things that woman does and her practicality. The other one I wanted to read is, let me find it here, Mary Ellen Tully. Tully or Tully?
Yeah.
Guzzle, Unbuckled Shoes. Now, I like this poem. I like the way it sounds, the repetitions in it and so on. But also this implication of the woman's life. Now, what are unbuckled shoes or what are buckled shoes? Somehow I'm picturing some kind of old-fashioned type of buckled shoes. But it could be just anything you have to deal with your feet. If it's hard for you to bend down and tie your shoes or buckle your shoes or whatever, and yet she still is working away. And it's some person I see sometimes in a store, and I think that person looks too old to be working at this store and waiting on me. I don't know. But sometimes I ask them if they like it, and they say they do. But you never know. Okay, Gosel, Unbuckled Shoes. Her arthritic hip won't bend to reach unbuckled shoes, so she heads to work wearing black unbuckled shoes. Her husband would grasp her foot to slide it inside, but can't breathe, bend down, reach her unbuckled shoes. She She leaves him with his oxygen hooked up at home, screen door flapping breezes like her unbuckled shoes. Easy on the gas, she drives small town streets where trees' dry limbs reach out to sun like her unbuckled shoes. Texas Dawn, Cracker Barrel restaurant, she clocks in, drinks a coffee cup breakfast in unbuckled shoes. The custodian props his broom beside her chair, stops around each day to buckle both her unbuckled shoes. They smile as stroller babies throw sandals across the restaurant floor and parents chase unbuckled shoes. At 70, she enjoys spending her store discount, part-time cashier standing in her now-buckled shoes. This well enough day at its end, she arrives home with tired feet, now dreaming of unbuckled shoes.
Oh, Barbara, thank you. Thank you for that. I really appreciate that acknowledgement of the pain involved, you know, sometimes in arthritis and old age, and so many people have to work now. And that was in a form also. It's one of the...
It's a guzzle, and it's on the page, it's two-line stanzas.
Two-line stanzas, and they with the same phrase repeated in every refrain.
Yeah, the last of it is. That's not true of all guzzles, but this one is set
right
up that way.
Well, Barbara, you're a born teacher, and I thank you so much. And we can you can stay on the line and listen, or you can go to the radio. And
I'll probably go to the radio.
Okay. Well, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for doing it this way.
Ian, it was wonderful to share this with you tonight. So thanks so much. And Patrick is going to start the recording now, the actual recorded part, and it opens up. I'll be the first reader, and we'll stop and do a little intro for everybody between. So thanks a lot, Barbara. Patrick?
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hello, Patrick.
Yes, I'm going to start the reading right now.
This poem.
That sounds really weird.
Is dedicated.
Hang on.
To Elizabeth Woody.
We are going to try something else. Why is it?
This poem is dedicated to Elizabeth Woody.
Barbara, you're still there, right?
Yeah.
Why is it so...
Most of my working life, I have worked at hospitals.
I'm trying to figure out why this sounds so
in
weird.
One capacity or another.
I don't know, Patrick.
This one is from... Most of my working life, I have worked at hospitals. In one capacity or another. This one... is talking about the riding the elevator in the hospital. It's called Elevator for Elizabeth Woody.
Can I just say something
here? The doctor is friendly on the
Go ahead.
Elevator.
Do you want me to pause this or
stop that?
Okay.
I started out by saying that most of my working life I worked as a medical transcriber, and this poem I was in a writing group with Elizabeth Woody at the time. And I dedicated this poem to her. It's called Elevator. Okay, that's it. And maybe you can start that poem again if you can.
I will. I don't understand why
this
it's
poem
doing that weird.
Is dedicated to Elizabeth Woody. Is talking about the riding the elevator in the hospital. It's called Elevator.
All right, Barbara, I'm going to try something else. I'm going to let it play for a second, and I'm going to hopefully...
Why else when he leaves?
Okay, while you're doing that, can I talk?
Well, either I'm going to play this or I'm going to let you talk. So if you want to just talk, that's fine.
Well, no, you play. We do want to hear the recording.
Yeah, I'm going to see if I can get a better copy of it.
Ah, okay. Well, can I entertain our listeners while you do
Please
that?
Please do. Please do.
Okay. I just wanted to say that this reading was held at Mother Foucault, which is a very unique bookstore, and it's on Southeast Morrison in Portland. I think the address is 523, something like that, Southeast Moore. I wasn't going to do this, so I don't have it. But I recommend that you drop in to Mother Fouca. It's totally unique, and lots of places to sit. Very hospitable to any literary endeavor that the owner, who's Craig Forrest, thinks is a worthy one. It's a great bookstore. And Caroline Wright, who journeyed down from Seattle to join us, really did. She worked nonstop for 3 years on this anthology, and she did an amazing job. There's 140 poems in it. More than 80 poets, and it's published by Lost Horse Press, and it came out just a few months ago.
Okay, so, Barbara, I'm going to try and play this other copy of it and see if it works,
okay,
if it's
right.
Not as noisy.
This one
sounds
is
better.
Talking about riding the elevator in the hospital.
Did I skip something or not?
No, fine.
For Elizabeth
okay,
Woody.
We'll just let this go then.
Okay.
The doctor is friendly on the hospital elevator as I ride to my work shift. But there's a strange flickering in the air when he gets off. It must be the tail of class slithering behind him out the door. Why else, when he leaves, would I suddenly see the mud on my shoes or feel a fear for my job like the powder of fine dust on my cheeks? Mm-hmm. And this is part two. The huddled group in the lot of the plaid pantry, backpacks and cheap wine, some of them left reservations. Some fought in the wars. Some of them walked across deserts looking for work. The crowd gets bigger and bigger. It spills out over the corner and crosses the street. When I fear that I'm losing my job, someone who is close to the streets, someone who keeps filling with poetry, tells me, first empty, then full. And I'll read another one. This is the one that's in the book, and those are the two of mine that I'm going to read. This is called Toy Box 1. Big loopy letters dotted with hearts. Such childish feminine handwriting. And such heavy consequences. The insurance examiner's signature. 2. The client sewed 5,000 gunny sacks a day for a whole year and now can't use her hands. But we deny her claim. A single mother with 3 children in an unheated trailer in the winter. Why should the company pay for her operation? We know that she carried water and firewood. By the time she started at the factory, she was already a cracked plate. 3. The examiner goes home at night and relaxes with movies. She likes the ones where ordinary-looking people are really secret aliens. And the one where, inside the darkness of toy boxes, pretty dolls turn to cannibals, begin gnashing their tiny teeth. Yes. Now, there are many, many caring people in the healthcare field, and unfortunately, I mean, doctors are very unhappy with the position that they're in now, except that the ones that are in it for the money and not to take care of people, And here's a poem about, let's see, this is by Laura Chauvin, and it's called The Mammographer. A few years at this machine and I forgot the breast itself, knew only what the low energy x-rays showed, the hazy map of ducts I passed to someone else, a fortune teller of sorts who saw things in the mist, a ghost congealing in that mass of cloud. I groan inside to see another blue gown open, breast resting passive above the ribs. What micro calcifications are hidden inside? My job would have been easier had God thought muscle, ligaments. Days come when I am undone by tenderness. I lift a breast, skin thin as a fontanelle, guide it to the camera's view. It's like taking the arm of someone small or frail. Sometimes, cupping a stranger's breast, I imagine my hand slipping under the head of a child I love, who has already fallen asleep.
Damn good.
Yeah, that's a good poem.
Damn good.
This is a, and here's an Ellen Bass.
I love you, Barbara.
Ellen Bass, Phone Therapy, and she's a great, great poet. As are everyone gathered in this room today, I must say, I have to say that. Phone Therapy. I was relief once for a doctor on vacation and got a call from a man on a windowsill. This was New York, a dozen stories up. He was going to kill himself, he said. I said everything I could think of. And when nothing worked, when the guy was still determined to slide out that window and smash his delicate skull on the indifferent sidewalk, "Do you think," I asked, "you could postpone it until Monday when Dr. Lewis gets back?" The cord that connected us, strung under the dirty streets, the pizza parlors, taxis, women in sneakers carrying their high heels, drunks lying in piss, that thick coiled wire waited for the waves of sound. In the silence, I could feel the air slip in and out of his lungs, and the moment when the motion reversed, like a goldfish making the turn at the glass end of its tank. I matched my breath to his, slid into the water, and swam with him. "Okay," he agreed.
Patrick.
And very interestingly, yes, in this anthology,
I think that we're going to cut that now. We're going to cut out the last poem that I recorded because
originator
around so much, and I want to get everybody in.
Okay.
So the next reader will go to the next.
Okay. So if you want to do an intro.
Yeah, and I'm going to introduce Willa Schneeberg, was the next poet, and I just want to say that this. There's so many fabulous poems in here. I had to cut some out of everybody's reading, and I was really sorry, and I cut a lot out of that one. Okay, Willa Schneeberg is a poet, visual artist, and social worker in private practice in Portland, and she's very, very dedicated to the healing arts. She's authored 5 poetry collections, including In the Margin of the World, winner of an Oregon Book Award, and Rending the Garment, a series of linked poems about a Jewish-American family. And here is Willa Schneeberg.
You can keep introducing her because I got to find the spot. Hang on.
Well, we cut out a poem. And after Willa is Penelope Scambly-Schott. And then Caroline Wright at the end. And Willa is particularly interested in helping women who've suffered abuse or who are needing healing of their confidence and self-esteem to be their best selves and to venture out into the world. Patrick, how are we doing? Hello.
Okay, sorry, it was way ahead.
Did so, I cut out a lot of mine? All right. Good,
well, it's okay. So I believe we are at Willa Schneeberg.
Willa Schneeberg, here we go.
And I think it's Willa Schneeberg.
This is the end of
the Yeah. Okay. So it's a pleasure to be reading again for Talking Earth. And I think of all the times that over the years that Walt and Barbara have invited me to read and be in KBOO at 10 o'clock at night and be allowed in that special way. And it always felt very intimate and very similar to the intimacy that I'm experiencing here. And I want to thank Carolyn Wright for this anthology and for her schlepping to Portland and making these events so special for all of us. Barbara suggested that we read some of our own poems about work as well as poems from the anthology, so I took her up on that. In my 20s, I had the opportunity to work in a geriatric hospital. It was very progressive for its day. It was actually one of those places that you didn't feel depressed when you walked in. There was a real life force among the elderly people there. And what was amazing is that someone had donated a letterpress print shop, which seems sort of wonderful to be in a bookstore like this. So it was basically, you know, Chandler and Price machines, you know, some had motors, some didn't, and I had just learned letterpress printing for poetry to be able to do broadsides. So part of my job as a rec therapist was to kind of manage this room, and the little old men would come in and use the treadle machines, and then they would make cards for the doctors. And we wound up doing a book of their poems. I was teaching a poetry therapy group, and it was a lovely memory, and I probably wouldn't have thought of it if it wasn't for the anthology. Print shop, Friday afternoon. E's distributed in their large spaces, double F's in their tiny spaces, chases upright in the rack, joints squirted with oil. When the old men leave, the metal plates gleam. All week talks hard above the presses weave. Rollers slide against type. Beds follow, their paper poised for impression. Friday afternoon, no hands jerk the handles, clanking the machines into motion. No one is here to name this upside down mirror writing language.
Awesome.
Any guesses why no one's there on a Friday afternoon? Any guesses? You probably know what you think.
Sylvia Plath.
It was a Jewish nursing home.
Jewish. Uh-huh.
They were getting ready for the Sabbath, so they had already they had left. The next poem that I'll read is by Courtney Davis, and it's called Hooked Up. And I'm going then to move into what I wound up doing later in life, is working as a therapist. Hooked Up. Drunk, partying, she and the man just hooked up. She tells me, the college student, the nervous, can't sit still woman dark-haired, laughing, pierced tongue, pierced navel, colored threads braided into bracelets around her wrist, barely making it through finals, graduating next spring, then maybe a master's. But for today, she says, the problem is fear. What if I caught something? This worry hooked into her, and now she slides down, eager but not eager for me to do cultures, blood tests, to tell her everything is fine. Oh, how often I've seen this. This fear twisted in as if there might really be a tangle inside. Shiny, metallic, like wire, and how each time I have to pull it out, strand by strand, trying not to weep over this one more woman hooked up. These barbs deep into flesh, and how they can only be extracted with moans and cries, each one ripping through until there is only this woman and me, helpless to do anything. But go on pulling the hooks from her, stuffing them into the garbage, telling her how sweet they must have seemed that night, how she must learn to recognize them before they gain entrance, how strong she must be now, how resolute. And the poem I'm going to end with is, I now make a living as a social worker in private practice in the Pearl. And what's interesting, I just remembered, Barbara, I think with a different title, you had this poem in your anthology, City, wasn't it called City Lights?
Yes.
I just remembered that.
Portland Lights.
Yeah, Portland Lights.
Uh-huh.
City Lights.
Yeah.
Where I'm getting that mixed up. Yes, Portland Lights. So Barbara did an anthology. How long ago did that come out?
It must have been 10, 12 years ago.
And it was poems relating to Portland, and this was included with a different title. It was Into My Office Walks Vietnam's Legacy. And for this anthology, it was retitled Into the Social Work's Office Walks Vietnam's Legacy. Portland, Oregon, 1997. With an uncomfortable giggle, she says she picked me because she read that ethnic minorities and sexual abuse were two of my specialities, and that she fit both categories. Her mother was from Dalat and met her GI father in a bar during the war. When her father was zonked out on crystal meth, a drug he first procured in Nam, she had awakened to find him on top of her in their trailer. There were always empty beer bottles spilling out of cabinets. She doesn't remember when her parents weren't drinking, but her mother did all the smacking, grabbing, slamming, and hurling. The round glass bowl filled with water and her fish, the color of the rainbow on in gasoline, left a scar below her eye. Her mother swept the dying fish into the trash. And this is in quotes now. Aren't I crazy calling my parents every week when they never call me? While she is still young and sexy, she finds a way to make her own money. She buys big, bouncy breasts. Men are stupid and lazy, she says. She is sure she has more repeat customers than the other girls behind the glass booths, also touching themselves, because they let drugs ravage their looks while she ended her orgy with coke 6 months ago. She says, why do I always pick the ugliest boyfriends? I know, because they won't leave me. She talks about having no women friends, but is scared to contact her best friend in high school, a Mormon, because she wouldn't understand her lifestyle. I loved going to her house, she said. They all sat down together and put cloth napkins on their laps. When she tried community college, she did well and can balance a checkbook just like her mother. She says, I want to get out of the life but I can't get up, give up the money. Do you think you can help me? Thank you.
Oh.
That was Willa Schneeberg, and Penelope Scamblish-Hott is the next reader. She is the much-awarded author of a novel, 9 poetry books, and 6 chapbooks. She'll talk about the many jobs she held on the way to getting her Ph.D. in late medieval English literature. She taught at Rutgers University and other colleges, and now divides her time between Portland and the tiny eastern Oregon town of Duffer, where she teaches an annual poetry workshop. Here's Penelope.
Hi, I'm Penelope Scamblish-Hott, and the poem that Willa Schneeberg just read would be a good entree into the poem that I have in the anthology, which comes from a whole book I did on the history of prostitution. Takes it through the centuries. This would be a late 19th century scene. And how are you gentlemen on this fine fall evening? In the gaslit parlor, 5 young ladies on love seats, satin evening dresses reflected in gilt-framed mirrors. A discreet bell. Madam opens the paneled door. Whiffs of cold creep from the hall, where 2 gentlemen lift their hats, unwind their knitted mufflers, the neatly pearled rose worked by wife or fiancé. Everyone smiles. The 2 brunettes, the redhead, even platinum Miss Lily, tossing her curls like a dare. A genteel soiree. Nobody mentions money or sex, but hips touch, a hand wanders, corks pop. Just so much even the most ardent gentleman cannot perform impaired. Time is money. The fellows choose. The banister up to the 2nd floor has been polished by sweaty hands. Discreetly, let us close the upstairs bedroom doors. The peephole looks in, not out.
Whoa.
I'd like to read you a couple others from the book about prostitution. It's called Lily Was a Goddess, Lily Was a Whore. My lover is the ceiling. The ceiling is my lover. I gaze into its cracked plaster. I am transfixed by yellowed ivory paint. I look unto heaven, whence cometh my salvation. Sometimes I don't remember which man sweats on top of me. When I was a child, in a pressed white pinafore, I lay on the cool lawn, watching clouds float. Above my head, the clouds flipped below me, so I was lying upside down, high over heaven. And one more from this collection. I did a lot of research for this book, including reading a lot and also interviewing several women in Portland, mostly young women who worked out on 82nd Avenue. And I, 2 of them, when I said, where would you like to meet? Let's have coffee. They suggested the cafe at Powell's.
So that's where I talked with them. And they were pretty frank. Again, like the patient that, or the client that Willa described, it was the money. It was the money. This is from a memoir of a woman who followed the gold rushes, first to San Francisco, and then up in the Yukon. If you want to make the money, you got to go where they're at. This new madam likes me because I'm willing to travel. But who knew we would always be moving? I'm not joking. We rode all the way up to the Yukon, where a miner dusted my whole body with gold. Afterwards, I shook out my sheet and hair carefully over the bar so the saloon keeper could get out his scales and weigh the gold dust. Hey, girls, trust me, travel pays. So, there are many kinds of work that women have done. I'd like to read a couple of other poems from this wonderful anthology. This is by Sandra Beasley. For 6 months, I dealt baccarat in a casino. For 6 months, I played Brahms in a mall. For 6 months, I arranged museum dioramas. My hands were too small for the Paleolithic. And when they reassigned me to lichens, I quit. I type 91 minutes per minute. All of them. Help! Yes, I speak Dewey Decimal. I speak Russian, Latin, a smattering of Tlingit. I can balance 7 dinner plates on my arm. All I want to do is sit on a veranda while a hard rain falls around me. I'll file your 1099s. I'll make love to strangers of your choice. I'll do whatever you want, as long as I can do it on that veranda. If it calls you, it's your calling, right? Once I asked a broker what he loved about his job, and he said, making a killing. Once I asked a serial killer what made him get up in the morning, and he said, the people.
Ted Bundy?
I was somebody else, I guess. I didn't write that poem. Woman Chopping Wood by Linda Hogan. I like the smell of pine in those rings of the axe. Feel the muscles growing in my arms. But the fire most always dies out at 3 a.m. Cold nights, and I can't hold it in my arms alone. I had an interesting experience as I've been a university professor for years, but for 5 years of that time, my classes were in the afternoon, and in the morning I worked as a home health aide. And boy, did I learn a lot about our society, because in the morning I was the girl from the agency making minimum wage, and in the afternoon I was Dr. Schott, who could give you a grade. So I felt that the work that I did, I keep dropping books, sorry. I felt like the work I was doing in the morning was way more important. Thank you, Willa.
You're telling the truth.
We try to tell the truth. That's why we write poems.
Patrick.
My first client was a wonderful old man.
I think we're going to have to get in the rest of the reading
for
the Penelope.
What it was going to be like
we're
going to
have
the other
to cut
clients.
The last poem. Can you do that? And
my first client, Mr. Nordley. The agency tells me he's 101 and lives
stop
in his daughter's
while I
house.
Read the introduction.
I show up
Carolyn
at the stated hour in my white tunic and pants.
Okay, we could just do that if you want.
Yeah.
I was going to say that I think we're okay, actually. But
If we're okay, I do have a one-minute introduction to Carolyn.
How about we'll cut to the next poem.
I have 3 minutes, 2 minutes for introducing Carolyn.
Yeah, we'll cut to the next poem then.
Should we cut that poem or?
Yeah, we are because I just stopped it. So
okay. Yeah. So should I introduce Carolyn?
Go
now?
Ahead and introduce Carolyn now.
Oh, I'm so sorry to leave out Penelope's wonderful poem and all the poems I had to cut out tonight.
Yeah,
however, come to live readings and you'll hear the entire menu of wonderful delights.
Or buy the books.
Yes, or buy the book. We'll buy the book for sure. Our last reader was Caroline Wright, who journeyed from Seattle. She's a contributing editor for the Pushcart Prizes and a senior editor for Lost Horse Press, which published this anthology. She has had a wide-ranging working experience as well as a distinguished literary career, like Penelope. She's been a waitress, a hotel maid, a hospital clerk, a freelance proofreader and textbook editor, a substitute bilingual fourth-grade teacher, and a Latin American sales liaison. Caroline has published 9 books of poetry, 4 volumes of poetry in translation from Spanish and Bengali, and a collection of essays. She lived in Chile on a Fulbright grant during the presidency of Salvador Allende and spent 4 years in fellowship in India and Bangladesh. She now teaches in her native Seattle for the Northwest Institute of Literary Arts MFA program and Seattle's Richard Hugo House. And here's Caroline Wright. And here you are, Patrick. Are we ready?
I believe so.
Thank you so much, Barbara and everybody. Actually, I realized I left out one profession. I also worked as an activities coordinator at a nursing home in Seattle. Oh, I'll have to write about that one of these days. But I'm going to start with First Job 17. Lucia Perillo is a poet who, she's had quite an interesting career, too, in the Forest Service and also teaching creative writing. She lives in Olympia, Washington at this point. First Job 17. Gambelli's waitresses sometimes got down on their knees, searching for coins dropped into the carpet, hair coiled stiff, lips coated in that henned shade of red, the banner color for lives spent in the wake of husbands dying without pensions, their bodies used in ceaseless marching toward the kitchen's dim mouth, firm legs migrating slowly ankleward. From that kitchen doorway, Frankie Gambelli would sic a booze eye on them, his arms flapping in an earthbound pantomime of that other Frank, the swooned over. "You old cunts," he'd mutter. "Why do I put up with you old cunts?" Never managing to purge his voice's tenor note of longing. At me, the summer girl, he'd only stare from between his collapsing red lids, eyes that were empty. Once I got stiffed on a check when a man jerked crazy-faced out of his seat, craned around, then bolted from those subterranean women, sweaty and crippled in the knees. Though I chased him up the stairs to the street, the light outside was blinding and I lost the bastard to that whiteness, and I betrayed myself with tears. But coming back downstairs, my eyes dried on another vision. I saw that the dusk trapped in by the restaurant's plastic greenery was really some residual light of that brilliance happening above us on the street. Then for a moment, the waitresses hung frozen in mid-stride, cork trays outstretched, like wide-armed reeling dancers,
the whole some humming and benevolent machine that knew no past, no future, only balanced glasses and the good coin in the pocket. Sinatra was singing, "Jealous Lover." All of us were young. I have to read Denise Duhamel's Unemployment. As we all know, when we've suffered unemployment, stretches of unemployment between jobs, we just always hope there's another job at the other end of that between. And this is sort of in the form of commandments. Denise Duhamel's Unemployment. For 6 days thou shalt labor and do all thy work. For 6 days thou shalt post thy resume, hand deliver thy resume, rewrite thy resume to best suit labor sought, mail thy resume overnight or priority, fudge thy resume. For 6 days thou shalt keep track of all thy efforts to qualify for an extension of unemployment benefits. For 6 days thou shalt feel guilty, cry, wring thy hands, redo thy checkbook, pawn thy TV and thy jewelry. For 6 days thou shalt fill out applications at chain restaurants, hospitals, retail stores, schools, offices of all kinds, including temp offices, banks, nail salons, hair salons, supermarkets, nursing homes, construction sites, topless bars, hot dog stands. For 6 days thou shalt set up an eBay account to sell thy dishes, and thou shalt bring thy best clothes to a consignment shop. For 6 days thou shalt call up favors and let go of thy pride. For 6 days thou shalt apply for no interest credit cards. For 6 days thou shalt fill out applications to become a telemarketer, a customer service employee, a tutor, a nanny, a janitor, a maid, a dog walker, a dog catcher, a cashier, a mail order bride. For 6 days thou shalt write letters to government officials when unemployment extension benefits are denied. For 6 days thou shalt labor and do all the work thou can find. Okay. Denise Duhamel, who... Yeah, she's
Patrick.
Wonderful. She's a very funny poet. Look up her work. She's wonderful.
We have time for the play
of
the rest
of it. I'm going to read, I don't have any of my own poems in the anthology because I made that executive decision, speaking of executive, you know, employment type terms, not to include any of my own work. But if I had, I might have put this poem in, which has to do sort of with an early job of my own. It's called Not On My Resume. I quit. I meant to tell the manager, Lurleen, as soon as I ducked into Pizza Haven that Friday afternoon to collect my final paycheck, a day off from my first crummy job at 17. Pale between my two thick legs, I slunk into the air-conditioned cigarette smoke chill, skin damp, cheese and pepperoni, a greasy, feasty haze. Pizza hell, I called the place. I was almost ashamed to show up. I was such a lousy waitress, mixing up orders, begging smoker co-workers to empty the ashtrays from my tables, smoothing unused napkins and pushing them back into the spring-loaded metal dispensers. I slowed the whole operation. Even then, a reduce, reuse, recycle fiend before the slogan had ever been invented. Lurleen met me in the aisle between tables, whose oilcloth covers I never could wipe clean. She straddled the passageway and growled,
You're fired. Her bulldog jaw worked as if a wad of chaw had found its rhythm and was perfecting its moves in her mouth. Get your paycheck and clear out. She blocked my way to the kitchen, her eyes drilling me with a roomy blue precision. I stammered, as I had when frat jocks slapped my derriere in each other's backs, then stubbed out their Marlboros in uneaten slices of perfectly good pizza I could have wrapped up and taken home on the sly. It would only have been thrown away. As I'd stammered when Dirk, the afternoon cashier, had caught me at the end of my shift, sliding uneaten slices wrapped in wax paper into my handbag. You can't fire me. I quit, I finally blurted. But Lurleen had already stumped back to the surgery.